Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcast's The New Talk. So in this podcast, we're going to talk about The Fourth Turning. This is a book that's been out for a while, which has caught the interest of the media because apparently the president's co-chief of staff, Steve Bannon, is alleged to have built his political philosophy on it. It's called The Fourth Turning, and we're going to talk about it in podcast 605. Well, I'm sitting here trying to figure out how to tie in exgovernmentcars.com to that intro, and I don't think it's possible. It certainly doesn't have anything to do with cycles or anything else. It has to do with dependable, awesome vehicles, cars and trucks and SUVs. And that's what Minnesota's only dealer, specializing in one owner, professionally maintained government fleet cars, trucks and SUVs, ex-government cars, is all about. They've got the Expeditions, they've got the Yukons, they've got the Crown Vics while they last, the Ford Police sedans, the Ford Police SUVs, the Chevy V8s. And of course, the Dodge Chargers. And I just want to say very quickly, because I've talked to Ed this month, and one of the things that they've got a line on these Border Patrol and Homeland Security SUVs, so Expeditions and Yukons, and some of them have very low mileage. And I will say from experience, getting an ex-government car with low mileage is really the golden ring of this stuff, because the lower the mileage, the better. Exgovernmentcars.com has it. So here's the deal. If you need a car and you have a job and you need a loan, you can get approved. And of course, Exgovernment Cars takes trades. Ed pays the highest value all the time without a lot of bull. They have the 3-day love it guarantee exclusively at Exgovernment Cars. What do you do? Get your butt down to Exgovernment Cars, now open in Golden Valley at 2420 Nevada Avenue North. Call them at 763-777-8782 or check out the selection at
exgovernmentcars.com.
Now, in the news these days, you're going to be hearing a lot of talk. In fact, there's going to be news today. If you're listening to this podcast at the end of February, you're going to hear news about attaching a tariff or a tax to goods made outside the United States when it comes into the country. So, you know, there's a lot of controversy and talk about foreign manufacturing and the new president. Some companies are preparing to bring some of their manufacturing back to the United States. If your company is considering American manufacturing, remember DepoStar, American design, engineering, and manufacturing. It's DepoStar, D-E-P-O-T, DepoStar. Visit their website at DepoStar.com. Okay, so in this podcast, we're going to be talking largely about reaction to a book by William Strauss and Neil Howe called The Fourth Turning. I am not going to do an academic review of the book. I'm not going to tell you much about what's in the book because that's not what's important right now, but I will tell you who wrote it and give you a little history of the two guys that wrote it and a little history about what the book says. So the book was written by William Strauss, who died in 2007. He was an amateur historian, playwright, theater director, and lecturer. Strauss is best known for his work with the other author of this book, The Fourth Turning, Neil Howe. Interestingly enough, Strauss described himself as someone in the entertainment industry because of his association with the satire group. You can see that he had some experience in drama, which is an interesting perspective to come from as a writer of a book that's really a political theory or a sociological theory. The other author, Neil Howe, is also an American author, an amateur historian, and consultant. So their book, as I said, is The Fourth Turning. This was first published in the 1990s. I will post a link to an interview on C-SPAN's book notes with them, so you can kind of, if you want to watch it, you'll get an idea of what they were all about. Oddly enough, one of the outcomes of this book and the others, other books that they also wrote after The Fourth Turning, they wrote some other books, but they coined the term millennial. So you can see the influence and power of some of the imagery that the two used in their books. This book first came to my attention at the bookstore. Remember bookstores? And then later, a listener to the talk show back at the radio station sent me a copy of this book and insisted that I read it after some emails and then demanded that I accept its theory. Well, I did read it, and I remember my reaction as being negative. because I thought the book and the theory were essentially determinist. Now, I will tell you a little bit about the theory, so I'm not going to leave you high and dry on that. But let me just explain what I mean by determinist. What is determinism? Well, determinism is the doctrine that all events, including human action, are ultimately determined by causes which are external to the will. Determinism and Marxism have been connected by some, and I want to caution everybody that I'm not conflating those two terms. I'm not using the term determinism in the sense to talk about Marxism, and I do not mean to imply that Strauss and Howe are or were Marxist. But my reaction to the book was that it was a sort of pop culture, easy explanation for the way things are in an odd sort of determinist way. And when I say pop culture, another book from that era, the 80s and early 90s, was a book called The Nine Nations of North America, if you read it. It seemed like it made a lot of sense at the time. I don't know that it does today. But basically, the book says that things operate on a cycle and there's nothing you can do about it and you have to ride these waves. This is what I mean by the determinist quality. It's almost beyond our wills. We have to react to things. And that is not a message I appreciate. It's like saying, and my mother says this all the time, well, you know, things are going to work. Don't worry, it'll work out. And my response to that is usually I get really upset because I don't like that worldview. Because basically, oh yes, things will work out one way or another, just maybe not the way you think or want. So I don't want to sit on my stoop just waiting to accept my fate. Because that's the thing about fatalist approaches. When you're left sitting there on the stoop thinking, why bother? I might just sit here and just wait for my fate to overtake my life. Obviously, it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it. If you just sit on the stoop and wait for your fate to reach you, then you'll never do anything. My father always said that you make your own luck. And another person in my life that I admire very much also said, the harder I work, the luckier I get. And I have found that to be true. Now, both of these gentlemen were not really it will all work out kinds of guys. It's just something people say, right? So the book, The Fourth Turning, is a pop culture history and sociology. I don't see it as academic, and that doesn't mean that everything that's any good has to come out of an academic background. But when it comes to history and sociology, as a commentator and business person, I have come to distrust pop theories. Now, suddenly there is a controversy about this book, going back to a Time magazine piece about Steve Bannon published recently that talks about how much Steve Bannon embraced this fourth turning. And it was revealed in this movie or video that he did called Generation Zero. Basically, the fourth turning says history operates on generational cycles and that the fourth turning is a cycle of chaos and breakdown. So American history operates on generational cycles and that the fourth turning is a cycle of chaos and breakdown. In the book, they identify 18 American generations going back to pre-revolutionary times, which is kind of weird. And that, you know, this fourth turning happens every so often. According to Time, in the video Generation Zero, Bannon focused on the key aspect of the fourth turning that every 80 years American history has been marked by crisis or a fourth turning that destroyed an old order and created a new one. Again from Time. The greatest crises identified by Strauss and Howe included the era of the American Revolution and the Constitution, the Civil War and its immediate aftermath, and the Depression and the Second World War, all conveniently, you know, within the time frames that they talk about every 80 years. Doing the math, they predicted another great crisis sometime in the first 15 years of the 21st century, or at least that's what the theory shows. Business Insider wrote that Bannon apparently believes that for the new world order to rise, there must be a massive reckoning, and that this is a time of reckoning. Now, you've also heard that term in pop culture, the reckoning, and that we will soon reach our climax conflict. This is, again, what Business Insider wrote that Bannon apparently believes. Now, I'm not going to do an academic critique of Bannon or the book The Fourth Turning. You are certainly welcome to read it yourself. Many already have. In the 1990s, oddly enough, it was the Democrats who really embraced it because of this discussion of the rise of the millennial generation. And in the 2000s, it was the so-called conservatives or the right and Republicans that embraced the book, which ought to give you an indication that what Strauss and Howe wrote is one of those vaguely written theories that just about anybody can sign onto because they see in it what they want once they're enthralled by the theory. So if you read it, try not to be enthralled by this theory that everything operates on cycles and that somehow we can apply those cycles to our own complicated history here in the United States, or pick any other country. You know, how would a cycle theory such as that apply to Germany, let's say? So what I'm going to do in this podcast is talk about my view of history as a cautionary tale about taking theories like this too much to heart, whether you're a voter or Steve Bannon or just somebody interested in this story. And I see it all the time, and I saw it again this weekend. Social media this weekend, you've got a lot of triumphalist Republicans talking up the president. And if you say anything like, well, you know, they will respond with every, you know, tool in the toolkit that they have because they are unable to engage in an objective conversation about what the president has done, what he could do, what he will do, anything that isn't triumphalist support for President Trump. And because they're supporters, which is fine, they're entitled to this, but because they're supporters, they see things only from this perspective of triumphalism. We got this guy elected, and now his victory has become, in their minds, much bigger than it was, and that his mandate has become much bigger than it was, and the forces arrayed against him are much bigger and more powerful than they were. Now, of course, those who did not vote for Trump, you know, the people that are opposed to Trump have the same kinds of blinders. It's the end of the world. He's a terrible person. He's a racist, on and on and on. So a worldview or a view of history can cloud judgment and make an objective analysis of what a political leader is doing very, very difficult. Now, I've read a lot of history. I don't think I could qualify as an amateur historian. I actually have friends who are actually amateur historians, and I'm nowhere near as disciplined as they are. Theirs is Indian war history out west, and Brad and his wife are really knowledgeable about that stuff, and I respect them greatly because of it, because they do a lot of work that I would never bother to do, but I read a lot. Now, when I was younger, I started with books about World War II, books about airplanes and stuff like that, and I found that I had an interest in all kinds of history, world history and U.S. history, and over the years, I've read a lot of books. I've given away a lot of my books, including The Fourth Turning, by the way. But some of these I keep with me. I still think Shelby Foote's magnum opus, The Civil War, is a phenomenal series. Three books that everybody should read about the Civil War. Gibbon's The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire is another series, and it's amazing. The Art of War in the Western World is just a book you'd have to look up, which details military tactics going back to the hoplites. And of course, I have The Federalist, and in all my books, you know, I have still with me about crime and Bonnie and Clyde in the 1920s and Carl Jung and all that stuff, because those are the things that interest me. But one of the things I've learned about history just from reading is that it takes time to sift through the facts, and new facts are constantly coming to light. It's not revisionist, but new facts come to light from time to time. And the further away that you get from the biases of the time, you then and only then begin to understand exactly what happened. So for my generation, you know, Vietnam figured very large in my generation. And I have to tell you that I didn't understand Vietnam at the time, but I had to wait a number of years before I could read a book about Vietnam to begin to really understand what it was all about. So history is very important, and usually it's the generation after the generation that experienced a period of time in a certain way. A new generation comes along that wasn't alive and didn't talk to any of those people, and they write books because they basically just look at facts and they come to conclusions, and then of course that causes controversy or doesn't, and other academics and other people who read those books make suggestions and new facts come to light and so forth. When I talk about new facts coming, for example, in the Civil War, somebody will find a cache of Civil War letters, and it will take some time for those to be authenticated, and then somebody will write a book about it or a dissertation about it, and then we'll begin to figure out how to incorporate anything new we learn from a cache of Civil War letters or a letter Abraham Lincoln wrote to somebody which might shed new light on some part of his administration. That's how history and writing about history actually works. We were all taught a certain history, depending on what schools we went to. Some schools are better than others, but most of us can read. We were all taught to read, and we can read new books and new work, and we can challenge the paradigms that we grew up with. And we can go back to school, too, and we can learn the discipline of actually being, you know, an historian, right? Isn't that how you say it? And an historian, and what that means, you know, what that actually entails. But I think one of the things you learn is history is not written on stone tablets by Yahweh. At different times, we view different events and different personalities and everyday people from an era differently. I mean, a movie about an era can change a perception of the people who lived in an era. And I sit in movies sometimes and I think, well, that's ridiculous. I remember watching The Gangs of New York, and I watched that movie and I said, well, that's ridiculous. That never happened. And I mean, I was at him about it. And then I went and I bought the book and I read it. And yes, in fact, yes, they did shell New York from New York Harbor at one point during that period of time with the Gangs of New York, because the gangs almost took over the city. Watch the movie. It's almost all of it is true, or at least it's true to the Herbert Asbury, you know, chronicling of the Gangs of New York. Herbert Asbury was an AP reporter in the 1920s. So he set out to give the gang history of all these major cities. They're phenomenal books. We don't set our history in stone in the United States either. I was raised in Illinois, and we were taught that Abe Lincoln was the great emancipator, that he saved the Union, and he was the best president in our history. And oftentimes I can remember, you know, being asked as a kid, who was the best president? Well, it was Abe Lincoln, because I grew up in the land of Lincoln. It was on the license plates. But it has been common these days to compare various presidents with our 16th president. If you want a good, you know, rep, if you want street cred, you want to be compared to Abe Lincoln, right? The great emancipator. But if you were raised in the Deep South, you might have a little different view of President Lincoln. In fact, even today, Southerners often refer to the Civil War as the War of Northern Aggression, and it may be a little tongue-in-cheek, but that's what they were taught. And I wouldn't call it a revision to say that today we know that Abe Lincoln was forced to function most of the time as a virtual dictator, using executive orders in wartime, pushing the limits of constitutionality to do what he thought necessary, which was to maintain the Union. Now, was he still the best president? That's your call, based on your reading and your ideas. You may have other ideas. You may think that he was, and you may think that preserving the Union was the most important thing. I don't know. I'm just saying this is a great example of new information changing people's points of view. Now, I also read an interesting book about the First World War with new facts I had never known, which, to quickly summarize, you know, I thought the Germans did the same thing that the Allies did with these constant wave assaults to deal with trench warfare, and that type of assault cut down the flower of British and French youth. And while the Germans suffered many, many casualties, I learned that the Germans developed quick dry concrete and cut their trenches in a way that they could provoke attacks and then withdraw quickly. So the Germans never suffered the level of casualties of the British and the French. Had it not been for the Americans, the Germans very easily could have fought that war to an armistice that would have given them a fair amount of territory, and how history might have been different from that. What else? I'm learning from reading all these books that about airplanes, and I've started reading these books about World War II aircraft, about engineering and design of these aircraft, and I have learned something new. I have learned that, in fact, the Germans, the Japanese, and the United States were pretty well matched when it came to fighters, and it was production and strategy that made the biggest difference in World War II, and how each command used the aircraft they had, because all of those aircraft, whether it was the ME-109, the Zero, or the Wildcat, let's say, all had, or the Corsair, had different advantages at different altitudes and different design functions that you had to figure out how to use them to their best advantage. Now, I never understood that before. I thought we just had the best plane. planes, and that's why we won. Because I never took the time to understand how these aircraft were designed and built, and when they were designed, and the requirements placed on the designers at the time based on what people knew at the time. So one of the things I've learned about history is we do the best we can with what we have at the time. So that's a really, really important thing to think about, because people in it, you know, I don't think they're operating on a cycle theory. I don't think the people that designed the F4U Corsair were operating on a cycle theory. They were given a task to design an aircraft with certain speed and power and climb capabilities and height capabilities and weaponry and so forth, and they designed it. They didn't say, well, let's check the cycle theory to see where we are on the invention scale. So we'll talk a little bit more about cycles here shortly. Well, we are still in winter. We were kind of excited because we thought there was going to be a big snowstorm, which was predicted. Again, somebody predicting the future, but it didn't quite work out, did it? But yes, winter is still here. It hasn't gone away. It's back, and your furnace and water heater are working overtime. And usually they last all winter without a problem. But if you have a problem, if you need emergency service, don't forget Ryan Plumbing and Heating, because when you have a problem, you want reliable service. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul. Where's my number for Ryan? What happened here? Something happened. Something happened with the numbers and the paper and everything else. Here is the number for Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. They go back four generations in St. Paul. Quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems. As I said before, a lot of people want to half-ass this stuff, and you're just going to have problems later on, and it's going to cost you more. Get it done right. Think about Ryan Plumbing and Heating if you have an emergency or something you need done. Quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems. Residential and business in St. Paul, 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. For four generations, Ryan Plumbing and Heating. So yeah, cycles. History based on cycles. So let's talk about business a little bit. Specifically, the idea that investment in markets is based on cycles. Many of you have heard of the Dow theory, which, by the way, isn't really a cycle theory. It's just a series of constants which apply to the market. There are, though, many cycle theory advocates related to Wall Street. Probably one of the least known but most influential was this guy named Nikolai Kondratiev. I hope that's the right pronunciation. Kondratiev, a Soviet economist who was executed for his theory of markets because, of course, it wasn't to the Kremlin's liking. But Schumpeter loved the theory and thought it should be called the K-wave, and it was named after this Soviet guy. Incidentally, K-wave theory postulates that there are four major cycles of investment: spring, summer, fall, and winter. Oddly enough, like the fourth turning, and of course, K-waves were invented decades before Williams and Strauss's books. Investor Harry Dent has a theory called spending wave theory, which is tied into consumer spending. Professor W. Thompson at the University of Indiana has a theory that's investment theory based on cycles. And of course, we've all heard of the Elliott wave theory in investment communities. In doing some research for this podcast, I was actually amused at the Zero Hedge blog, which featured a blog post about these theories that predicted a collapse was, quote, just around the corner way back in 2014. So we didn't really have a collapse between 2014 and 2017. So if you had invested based on that theory, would you have lost money or what? Would you consider investing all of your money using one of these cycle theories? And so would you consider running the country based on a cycle theory? Well, quite honestly, if you did, and if you actually did base running the country on such a theory, I think that you would be a fool. Why do I say that? Well, let me read a quick excerpt from this article about Steve Bannon and his quote, and I don't know if he really is. It's quote unquote this obsession that he supposedly has with the fourth turning. And this is the quote from Business Insider. This is not me. Strauss and Howe's major prediction has now obviously come true. Few would deny that the U.S. has been in a serious political crisis for some time, marked by intense partisan division, a very severe recession, war abroad, and above all, a breakdown in the ties between the country and its political establishment. Well, this conclusion encapsulates much of what I think is deeply wrong with today's reporting and commentary, and probably the way we view things in this country. Are we in a serious political crisis? Well, I'd have to say I don't really see it that differently from the shock and anger on the left when Reagan was elected in 1980, which, by the way, was a huge surprise, particularly the true electoral landslide that he garnered. And I'm not suggesting, by the way, by saying this, that Trump is another Reagan. Far from it. I would say that the summer of 1968 through the Kent State shootings in 1970 was pretty much a political crisis, which caused one president to refuse to run for the second term and ultimately forced another one to resign, not to mention the economic crises that perhaps were tied to the Vietnam War and the Vietnam War itself. I often talk to my mom about the 20s and 30s. And what things were like. And her comments about the World War II period are really interesting because that was a political crisis. I mean, the Depression was a political crisis, if we ever had one. And she, you know, never really mentions the actual stock market crash. You know, the run-up to World War II, she said, we all knew something was wrong, but people did not understand. And I would mention that a million people marched in the summer of 1940 to keep the United States out of the war, of World War II. Was that a political crisis? Yes, because it really severely curtailed FDR's ability to intervene to stop it before it started. So was there an intense partisan divide? Yes, there was. You know, Congress was very divided. Congress was very divided in the Civil War. Congress has been very divided throughout our history. We have been very divided throughout our history. You know, the boom of the 1920s could be characterized by, you know, you had the rise of populism before the 1920s, and you had rural America very much opposed to urban America because the needs of urban and rural America differed substantially. You know, the Dust Bowl is a great sort of little paradigm to think about because, you know, if you think about the Dust Bowl and the things that were happening around that time, whether it was Bonnie and Clyde or the, you know, the rise of the mafia in New York and Chicago because of Prohibition, you know, were we in a political crisis? You know, I'm sure for most people it felt like everyday life. And again, do we have an intense partisan divide? Well, what I know of U.S. history, as I've just demonstrated, is I think we've always been divided, and rather intensely, which is probably pretty good for the United States to have a country where people can be divided politically. Have the ties between the country and its political establishment broken down? Well, you know, I don't think that the ties between the people and the political establishment have been characterized by anything other than deep mistrust from the beginning. Isn't that the whole argument about Federalists and anti-Federalists going back to the very beginning? If you will, both the right and the left and even the libertarians today report more interest and more people getting involved. That does not suggest a separation between the people and the political establishment. Is the country in crisis? I don't think so. And I think people on the right thought the country was in some kind of crisis when Obama was president, and yet here was a man who was reelected. And I think people on the left now think the country's in crisis because they don't like Trump. I've been all over this country. I've been all over almost every square mile of it many, many times in my life. And most recently, a lot of it. And I can tell you from year to year, it looks pretty much the same as it did when I traveled the byways of Iowa and Southern Illinois, the Mid-South and the Deep South with my parents in the Buick Electra back in the 60s and early 70s. Quite honestly, it's better than then because now you can get a Starbucks in every little town, or you can find a yoga studio, or you can get a Culver's, right? So there's a lot of things that actually are better than they were. And everybody has cable, and everybody has internet, and everybody has Wi-Fi. Sometimes it doesn't work so good. Everybody has cell coverage. So I don't know that we're in this crisis that all these reporters and these commentators talk about it. I look at it this way. What happened is a new president was elected. his election was a big surprise because all the supposed smart people thought it was going to be someone else. The people that supported that other candidate thought it would be her. And so everyone is shocked and surprised. The people that supported the Trump ticket were positively surprised. So victory obviously has realigned what people think and what they talk about, because you have, an end of an era. You have one president leaving, a new one coming in. They're very different. And certainly some thinking is going to be realigned. Is it on a cycle? Come on. What is to come with this presidency is more important than what has happened. And as I said to friends this weekend, it isn't what they say that's important right now. It's what they do, and they've only been in there a month. And if what this president does works, well, then a lot of this historical coverage is going to die down. If it doesn't work, that's another thing. But I can be sure of one thing, and I think you can be sure of one thing, and that is there will be a crisis. And that crisis will go a long way to defining the new presidency, both for the people who supported this president and for those who do not. Some presidents get through 8 years without anything real significant happening. Some presidents have truly significant crises. I would say Obama kind of got through without having any crisis, a real type of a banking crisis or a military crisis or an existential crisis. I don't personally think that Trump will, just because we didn't really have any major thing happen in the last 8 years. As far as what kind of crisis, banking crisis, stock market crash, whatever, a military crisis of some kind, a social crisis of some kind, some unexpected existential threat. Your guess is as good as mine. But here's the thing. You cannot predict that crisis. That's why we call them black swan events, because they're unpredictable. Certainly, you can look back on it and say, we could see that that was going to happen. But when you're in it, you do the best with what you have. You can't run the country on, FDR didn't win World War II because he was checking the cycle theory every day. He won World War II because my understanding of his presidency was he delegated authority to people who knew what they were doing and responsible, and kind of tried to give them the resources that they needed and help them along whenever he could. And they and he and the whole country did the best with what they had to win a specific outcome. Was it perfect? Well, we now know in history that no, the victory in World War II wasn't perfect, but they did the best with what they have and what they had at the time. So this whole idea of being able to predict crises and react, it's like going back in time and being able to change something by going back in time. There are some people that theorize that you couldn't even go back in time and prevent JFK from getting shot that day. So it's hard to say what causes things to happen and why, and what forces are at work. You can certainly make predictions based on cycle theories and based on what you know, but you could be wrong too. And unfortunately, you can be catastrophically wrong if, for example, you've invested every cent of your money on that particular thing. Because the world, in my view, is not predetermined. This is the whole concept of free will. And I'm going to define free will because apparently I have to do this these days. Free will is the ability to choose, think, and act voluntarily. For many philosophers, to believe in free will is to believe that human beings can be the authors of their own actions, and to reject the idea that human actions are determined by external conditions or fate. And if you look at the great leaders of time, they believed in this idea that nothing is written. Go back to Lawrence of Arabia, who was the biggest rejoinder to anything that he suggested with the Arabs when he, organized them to defeat the Turks in the First World War and defeat the Ottoman Empire. They would say to him, "We can't do that." And he would say, "Why?" And they would say, "Because it is written." And he would say, "Nothing is written. We are writing it." And we as Americans really have to be careful of being taught that it is written and therefore it must be. We make our own future. We make our own luck. And you cannot possibly take into account. Actually, here's the reason. You cannot possibly take into account every variable. And in any one theory, you can't take into account every variable. about trends or society or politics. So no one single theory can be right about what is really going on out there. You know, we often call it the art of war, which is basically managing resources during the fog of war. We often call it the art of politics, which is very similar. I am not going to say, and I can't say for sure, whether my son or my grandson's generation is going to be able to do this or do that when they are my age and I am dead and gone. I can tell you that they're going to enjoy many new technologies, any one of which could have the power to completely remake the world and blow up every cycle theory and every other theory of society and the future and business, you know, in any way. And I'm talking about artificial intelligence or 3D technology or any of the things that are happening today, which could any of them could conceivably blow up all of it. And I just don't understand why people simply can't live their lives and let things unfold. It doesn't mean that you have to be an uninvolved observer. It doesn't mean that you can't have passionate opinions. But this need to latch on to fortune telling to predict the future is really becoming a problem. For example, the massive predictions of the massive snowstorm that never hit here a week ago or so. We cannot know the future. And we can't prepare for what we think may come and should be. We just have to do the best with what we have at the time. And some of us are better at handling those resources and figuring out what to do than others. We will never know exactly what the future holds, which kind of is part of the fun of living, because you get to find out tomorrow what happens. Isn't that what it's all about? Isn't that the fun of life? Don't forget Ryan Plumbing and Heating for emergency service, especially if you have burst pipes or any kind of an issue, and you never know when that's going to happen. You can't. Is there a cycle theory for plumbing? I don't think so. What there is there's help from a quality plumber, and that's Ryan Plumbing and Heating. Four generations in St. Paul. They can help you if you have emergency service needs. And if I can find the number, I'll find it. Here we are in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. In St. Paul, 651-224-4771. Online at ryanplumbing.com. They've been serving the metro area for 60 years now and still running Ryan Plumbing and Heating. And if you want to get a line on those expeditions and Yukons from Homeland Security and Border Patrol, low mileage government fleet cars, one owner, professionally maintained cars, trucks, and SUVs, the Crown Vics, the Dodge Chargers, the Chevy V8s, the Crown Vics, the Expeditions, the Yukons, and more, xgovernmentcars.com.
xgovernmentcars.com.
Thanks for listening to podcast 605, right on the page at the bobdavispodcast.com with the streaming. A lot of people are checking that out. Also on iTunes, where people are subscribing. You can subscribe right off the page. You can subscribe on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher.com, blogtalkradio.com. And of course, thanks for liking, sharing, and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter. Always appreciate the donations for mobile Podcast Command, getting ready for spring operations. You know, last year at this time, I was out covering the campaign, and the donations helped me immensely because they kept me in Komodo Dragon coffee and diesel fuel and beef jerky and macadamia nuts. I'm getting ready to go out again. I'm not going to say where or what, but it's going to be cool. So thanks for your donations at thebobdavispodcast.com. Click on the banner at the top of the page with the picture of Mobile Podcast Command, or click on the donate button and you're good to go. Thanks for listening to Podcast 605.
Off the porch like mom's not home. Just a couple kids living.